What we actually say is that there is no more value in child's rights or a woman body than there is in a chatbot or a virtual assistant. And that is just something that I cannot stand calmly. And for me, that risk of not respecting humans or not taking the human perspective and instead prioritizing the machine perspective, like, I think that is the danger that I hope we will overcome quite soon as we all engage with generative AI more and kind of start seeing that, yeah, it's just a predictive model.
Welcome to the Regulating AI podcast. Join host Sanjay Puri as he explores the dynamic and developing world of artificial intelligence governance. Each episode features deep dives with global leaders at the forefront of regulating AI responsibly, tackling the challenges using AI can bring about head-on and enabling balance without hindering innovation.
Welcome to the Regulating AI podcast. Artificial intelligence, AI, stands at the forefront of technological evolution, with experts predicting that it could add trillions of dollars to our GDP, but it could also negatively impact our workforce and national security. So how do we regulate it without stifling innovation? Our podcast features insights from various perspectives. We've had industry leaders and CEOs. We've had government officials, members of Congress, Senate, EU advocates, and we have had leaders of advocacy and civil rights groups. Together, they address pivotal questions that are needed to create practical legislation. I'm very excited to have Dr. Irina Merkina with us today. Irina is the Innovation Manager and AI Lead at the Office of Innovation at UNICEF, an international organization. She was also an AI expert for the European Commission. I invited her on this show as it is very important to get many different perspectives towards framing AI legislation, and we need to get the perspective of international organizations. Welcome, Irina. It's an absolute pleasure to have you on the Regulating AI podcast.
Thank you, Sanjay. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thanks. Irina, can you please tell our listeners about your journey from being an AI expert for the European Union to your current role at the UNICEF, please?
It was an interesting career that I've had. I started as a researcher, a data scientist who worked in academia for many years. And I got involved as an expert for the European Commission, precisely from that academic background. Then I switched to the private sector and used all of those skills to build models and algorithms for profit organizations. And then in 2022, when the world started going off the rails more and more, I thought of how to use my skills for social good, to build AI algorithms that can actually make this world slightly better. And this is how I ended up in the humanitarian sector and joining UNICEF. And ever since then, working very specifically on AI for social good.
That's fantastic. We need more people like that. How do you see the role of international organizations like UNICEF in shaping the regulation and governance of AI on a global scale? For a lot of our listeners in the US who might not be familiar with UNICEF, just if you can just give a line or two about what UNICEF does.
Well, I would hope that everybody knows UNICEF, the United Nations Children's Fund. It's a 70-year-old organization that works very specifically for children's rights. And that includes many different fields, from health to education to emergency response to child protection and social protection. UNICEF operates in all countries all over the world and always tries to protect children, as they are always the most vulnerable category of population, marginalized on an unimaginable scale. But also, children are our future. They are the world of tomorrow. So protecting children is something that we keenly believe in and work very hard for. UNICEF has a very strong stance, obviously, and a very important role in advocating for responsible AI and for using AI for social good. UNICEF has published policy guidance on AI for children back in 2020. one and has held workshops with different governments to convince them to include provisions from that policy guidance in their national AI strategies. One of the main considerations is that a lot of AI systems, probably the majority of them all over the world of all different kinds, will affect children and do affect children daily, from image recognition to social media algorithms to texts, obviously generative AI. However, most of those systems have not been developed with children in mind. So they include provisions like the user have to be able to give consent for data use. However, most children cannot legally give consent, and in many cases may not understand what it means that they are interacting with an AI system and not with a human agent, right? Because they may not see the difference between a chatbot and a Santa Claus, right? So UNICEF works very hard on advocating for children's rights in the UN discussions about AI legislation, both national legislation and also international efforts to try and standardize some of the regulations. Because, as we all know, AI systems could be produced on data extracted in one country and labeled in another country, and then the system itself has been developed elsewhere. So regulating that international, or creating those international frameworks, is very important for us.
Yeah, as you rightly said, children are really the key, and they are the most vulnerable to any technology now, especially AI. So keeping that in mind, Irina, what are some of the key challenges that you have encountered, especially in democratizing AI, and how do you propose in overcoming them?
Well, there is no, obviously, there are no short and easy or simple answers. We all know that. What we are trying to do is overcome the challenges that we see coming. Some of those main challenges are obviously the growing digital divide. It refers to all digital technologies, right? The lack of connectivity in many countries, the lack of digital skills, or the digital equipped task force or labor force in most countries. We try to build local capacity, right? So it's not about, okay, we will encourage the development of AI systems in Silicon Valley and then happily ship them elsewhere, right? The whole world needs to work on overcoming the digital divide so that each and every country has AI capacity in place that is adapted for their local context, that is able to use their local data, and build systems that not just extract value, but also deliver value for each country, for each region, for each community in place. Overcoming that digital divide is not easy. We have been working on it for many years, and it feels like that job is never done. There are different modalities that we employ. And yes, international cooperation is one of them. Promoting open source AI systems is another. And yes, advocacy and regulation is something that we do. We also just invest in local AI solutions. We have a venture fund at the Office of Innovation that invests in startups that will deliver solutions that advance UNICEF missions, but also help developing the local AI capacity and kind of develop digital skills for the people who will use those systems.
Wow. So just to unpack, you said some very important things. My gosh. Firstly, digital divide. Now, when you're talking about it, is on a global scale, because even in the United States itself, we have a digital divide in rural to cities, and even in cities like in urban and others. But you're talking about, and I think what you're also referring to is AI should not become an English language Western, or maybe just a Silicon Valley experiment, because when you look at the rest of the world, Irina, and you are an expert, I'm just saying this, majority of the people, yes, English is an important language, but there are many other languages, and there's history of civilizations that are written not in English. That is the issue. So now we are talking about an AI divide that could happen, and especially the global south, as they call it. So what you're saying is UNICEF has an innovation fund that is investing in local AI solutions. Wow, that is something very important for our listeners. I didn't know that. And these are local large language models that are being developed for local languages and things of that nature.
We don't work just with the large language models. We support all types of AI that might include systems for machine translation, that could include systems that do use generative AI for helping to develop lots of content for teachers that they can use in the classroom. As you rightly said, there is a dire lack of models that work with other languages than English, right? For low resource languages, that is a problem that we are trying to overcome. However, we also invest in other systems, in health and education, in emergency response that go beyond just language models. But they all struggle with the same type of problems, which would be, yes, they all are built for the Western English speaking democratic societies with a very particular set of values, which is very American based, right? So one of the experiments that I've done recently, if you ask systems like GPT or large language models to describe a typical morning with a typical breakfast, it describes a breakfast that is very much American, or mostly urban American, I would even add, which would not be true for the rest of the world. So for the rest of 7.5 billion people on this planet, that would be something that they are not familiar with, and that would not describe their breakfast or their lives. And that lack of perception, I guess, that just contributes to the digital divide, because all those differences in cultures, in values, in data, they become invisible if we don't promote AI development that is based on local context and local data.
That is so true. Irina, just one last follow-up to this. I mean, obviously the challenges are there in the digital divide. But the big thing, and we've had many education experts that have come in on the show, and they say one of the biggest opportunities, personalized education using AI, in the sense you have skills different than me or than anybody else. We have one size fits all for education, for health, and AI can be that personalized tutor where somebody in Malawi could get MIT, Harvard, or even somebody in rural Iowa could get that. Do you see that when you start talking about children, that as a big opportunity also?
Yes and no. First of all, for me, the concept of a personalized education and one size fits all, those two are contradictions in terms, right? Personalized education would mean that each child would get education that is best suited for them, right? That might mean education close or developed on local context, developed with a deep, profound knowledge of local history, wherever that is, which if you cannot just translate an MIT course and say it's going to apply. There are technical courses like mathematics would be the same, I would guess, across the world. However, the way children are taught math would be different across the world. They start to kind of build up those abstract thinking skills would be different. So not adapting that education and expecting that one size fits all would somehow become also personalized. For me, that just doesn't work. The second thing is there are great things with personalized education that enable, for example, teachers to a focus on the connection parts of education, on encouraging children to learn, on inspiring them to develop their concept thinking, abstract thinking, on actually delivering education that is building their life skills, whereas AI probably can take care of generating loads of content on a massive scale. However, for me, AI should not be a replacement for teachers and should not be kind of the only option available to children, because that is also dangerous. On the one hand, yes, AI is an endlessly patient tutor that will read the same story for you 300 times again and will never tire. And that's fantastic. Maybe that's what the child wants. On the other hand, maybe the child needs the right to make mistakes and the right to mess around and to play and to be creative. And as we all know, AI is super great at mediocre, very average responses, something that fits the pattern. It is not very good at building up the outliers and letting them become something extraordinary, because that extraordinary, by definition, is outside of the norm. So there will be a huge potential for human engagement and for teachers to become even more important as personalized education will be more available for children. That would be my take on this.
Okay, that's an important perspective that you have. Just shifting a little bit in the sense, how can we make sure that AI technologies are developed and deployed in a way that prioritizes the needs and rights of all individuals, especially you talked about the vulnerable population, the children who are the most vulnerable. So how can we make sure that these AI systems are developed in such a way and deployed in such a way that their rights are also considered?
We start by actually asking them, right? A lot of the problems with the current state of AI, especially AI regulations, stem from the fact that a lot of decision-making power stayed over the years in the well-developed industrialized countries who made the decisions that suited them without considering the rights and the values and the interests of other groups of population. So if we are developing AI systems for children, we need to ask children, right? We need to ask young people. We need to involve them as fully, like, stakeholders with full rights and not just the future users. We cannot say for them what would be good for them. The same is about overcoming the digital divide. If we say that the global south will be affected, then we absolutely have to. It's a must. It's not an option. We absolutely have to involve stakeholders from the global south from the beginning in all of the policy-making discussions and in all of the international regulation discussions. If we are not doing that, if we are making assumptions about what would be good, then we are kind of reinforcing the same dynamics of power and colonialist perspectives that got us into the not very equal societies in the first place. So just not repeating the same mistakes and making it possible for the vulnerable populations to make decisions, to be agents for themselves, is the only way forward.
You made two points. One is obviously talking to the children. When you say talking to the children, in some ways it's talking to organizations that represent the children, like UNICEF and others. And then you said involving the global south is absolutely critical so that we don't repeat the mistakes of the past. Do you think we are talking to the global south at this point?
Yes. I mean,
overall, is the AI community talking to the global south? I'm not talking about you per se, but
it's hard for me to talk on behalf of the whole community. In those international discussions that UNICEF or the UN system in general are involved, the Secretary General's high-level advisory body on AI, for example, does include stakeholders from and experts from the global south. So I know that there are discussions on AI regulation and on AI use and deployment that do include. However, I'm sure that we can always do more. And again, I would not speak on behalf of everybody in the AI community.
Just building an AI system has the processing power, the talent. It's a pretty expensive process. Now, when we say involve the global south, they have a lot of different priorities. They have basic things that they're trying to deal with. And I'm just trying to figure out, we have to say, hey, invest hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars in building your localized AI systems while you have basic fundamental things. Because I don't think people are going to win elections based on, hey, I built the first localized AI system. So I'm just, again, this is just something because you raised some very interesting points. I'm just trying to think how that kind of plays out. Irina, what are there any examples or initiatives or projects where AI has been used for some humanitarian challenges within UNICEF?
Looking to make the most out of AI advancements and innovation? Visit regulatingai.org to learn more about how best to optimize the use and integration of AI, and sign up for the Regulating AI newsletter to keep up to date with the latest in AI governance and regulation.
Yes, for sure. And it actually kind of illustrates really well, I think, your point. It's very hard for many countries, and particularly for at the community level or regional level, to develop their own AI systems. When we say that we support open source AI development, that is also our commitment to making sure that the systems, the data, the models will become available after they have been developed in one context for one stakeholder. Somebody else can use them to solve similar type of challenges and problems without spending all that money all over again to develop their own solution. Some of the successes, I mean, I can brag probably for the rest of this podcast just about the things that we have done. But we have a system that maps pockets of wealth in the Philippines, and that has been scaled for more countries ever since, trying to help social protection division to discover where are the people in need versus what the government statistics says. Okay, this is a wealthy neighborhood. You don't need to engage there. We have machine translation algorithms that help us to, again, there is a lot of critical information that UNICEF produces or needs to deliver to people all over the world. And we obviously produce it in the 5 official UN languages, but there are many more languages that people need information in. So just the ability to scale that in some of the most critical situations, sometimes in the humanitarian response for the volunteers and emergency responders, that is just something that has been very critical for us. We develop a lot of predictive analytics and forecasting for predicting natural disasters, and particularly cyclical natural disasters such as droughts and floods, and develop an early warning system so that people can get out of the dangerous areas. We have a wonderful initiative called GIGA that UNICEF has together with the International Telecommunications Union that maps every school location in the world to connect each of those schools to the internet so that children have access and teachers have access to the wealth of knowledge and wealth of information that they otherwise would not have. So again, using AI for social good, for mapping schools, is something that has had an immense impact because the government statistics in many cases missed those schools and did not count on schools in remote areas. I can give you more examples, but I think it's easier if I just refer people to the Office of Innovation website at UNICEF. And we have stories and reports that we are very proud of work. We can really see the impact that responsible AI development can deliver.
You have, as you said, you have many areas that you have been working on, which are very impressive, and people can obviously check them out on your website. But thank you for that information. What role do you see for civil society and grassroots movements, basically, in influencing AI regulation and policymaking? Do you see a role for those kinds of organizations?
I mean, again, civil society representing their own interests are vital stakeholders in, and should be vital stakeholders in all discussions on AI regulations and AI deployment. It is thanks to them that we have advancements in legislation such as the European Union AI Act and the executive order in the US that have actually taken the societal perspective rather than the big tech perspective that was more about, okay, protecting innovation or protecting the right for those companies to earn a lot of money. Grassroots organizations have a better understanding of what are the complex issues on the ground, so they're also much better at formulating challenges that could be solved with AI, particularly if they can partner up with international organizations or big tech partners. And they most certainly have a strong role in just advocating for responsible AI use and responsible development, not just use, that would benefit everybody, would benefit societies and particular groups of people, right? So again, I would try and avoid speaking on behalf of everybody. Where we need civil society is that people with lived experience, people with particular perspectives can bring those perspectives so that they are heard, their perspectives could be taken into account in the decision-making process. That includes, obviously, organizations that work for people with disabilities, that work for the LGBTQ rights, that work for the rights of women and children, obviously.
And do you think a lot of them are getting a seat at the table right now? People with disability, rural, and all these other people, because that's what our podcast is. We bring, we've had education people, we've had manufacturing companies, all the people, but what is your view? Are they getting a seat at the table, or at least their views heard?
I feel that my point of view is a little skewed because I see the best examples of what could be possible.
Good. We want to see the best too.
UNICEF has its own, for example, disability inclusion strategy, and we involve people with disabilities in the documents and providing their perspectives in whichever strategies or projects we develop. Whether or not that is true for the whole world, it is hard for me to say. But then again, I'm a firm believer in leading by example. If the world can see many organizations doing the same, it will be like, okay, you don't have an excuse to not involve civil rights organization in your decisions. So I'm sure that, or I hope that this will be a positive trend where they do get a say in everything.
I sincerely hope that. Irina, you mentioned that you're a big supporter of open source systems for AI. Now, there is a school of thought, when you look at OpenAI, Microsoft, etc., which are more of a closed platforms, that it could get in the wrong hands and it could cause a lot of issues. So your thoughts on that, and what other dangers of AI you feel worry you? So open source, getting in the hands of the wrong people, and anything else about AI that concerns you from its dangerous standpoint?
Oh gosh, how much time do we have? Specifically for open source, obviously it's not such a black and white issue as I would have loved it to be. Yes, there are immense benefits for open source, just like with software. A lot of closed source systems, software systems have been developed on that one open source component that has been supporting it. And it's the same thing with AI. Without open source AI systems, the development would be much slower and in many cases impossible for anybody outside of Silicon Valley. And that's just not the future that we can accept. However, we see a lot of problems, obviously, first of all, with misuse of potential and realized misuse of open source AI systems, generative AI contributing to misinformation and deep fakes and so on, but also data privacy violations, copyright violations and so on. It's not easy to say, yes, we all need open source solutions. If we develop open source solutions, then there needs still to be standards, there need to be guardrails, and there need to be a much better understanding of how do we mitigate the risks that are coming from it, right? So there needs to be a redress mechanism. There needs to be a much stronger regulatory mechanism for mitigating the impacts, right? So the problem with deepfakes is not that AI is somehow really good at producing realistic images. The problem with deepfakes is that there are bad actors. So how do we catch those bad actors? How do we find them? How do we prevent deepfakes from spreading? Right. So that is the responsibility that I think a lot of actors, big tech companies, social media companies, and a lot of regulatory agencies need to take a lot more seriously going forward. And then other risks of AI, I'm obviously very worried about discrimination and AI just contributing to the increase, kind of scaling up all the existing inequalities, and that includes gender inequality, that includes racial and ethnical inequality. So for me, that blind trust in the technology being neutral simply because it's a machine, that kind of makes me spiral into, oh no, we should prevent that from happening. But also very specifically, and that might be one pet peeve of mine, but something that I've seen quite a lot over the past year as generative AI became more and more prevalent. And that is the tendency to make conversations about AI sound as if they are human, and they're not. They're not intelligent. They don't have more intelligence in them than a calculator, right? It's just a probabilistic machine. So whenever I hear the talk about AI machines gaining consciousness or being close to gaining consciousness, that is, on the one hand, that takes us a little too far into the sci-fi conversations, which may not be productive. On the other hand, working for the human rights organization, if we say that the machines are just like humans, what we actually say in that instance is that we devalue humans. What we actually say is that there is no more value in child's rights or a woman body than there is in a chatbot or a virtual assistant. And that is just something that I cannot stand calmly. And for me, that risk of not respecting humans or not taking the human perspective and instead prioritizing the machine perspective, like, I think that is the danger that I hope we will overcome quite soon as we all engage with generative AI more and kind of start seeing that, yeah, it's just a predictive model. It's not actually conscious.
From a danger standpoint, it's obviously open source without standards is what you said, deep fakes, growing inequality and discrimination. Well, those are some of the big ones. I'm sure there's a long list there. One question I have, which you did not touch upon, and again, I don't know how it, at least in the US, there's a big conversation happening about mental health, especially with young people, whether they're children, teens, or, and there's a lot of work that's happening in terms of how AI can potentially help with some of the things like loneliness and other things. Now, obviously, it can also increase some of the mental health issues. And I know you think you're more in the camp that it could be a big problem. Do you see any potential for AI to help with some of these mental health issues? Because there are now chatbots, because loneliness is, as our Surgeon General in the US said, loneliness is we are in a loneliness crisis in this country. So there are now chatbots that are like human, which have got like 20 million plus users. That tells you the status of where we are at. So just one quick thought on that in terms of children that you have talked about, the vulnerable population and mental health.
It's a very sensitive issue. On the one hand, obviously loneliness is a crisis, and not only in the US, and loneliness is not the only mental health issue that affects all people all over the world. In many countries, there are not enough mental health services. So in the US, at the very least, whether or not you can afford it, that's another topic. But at the very least, there is a developed therapy industry, right? In many countries, there is either a stigma around mental health or just not enough specialists to go to. So I understand very well the need for more mental health support and how people think of, okay, whatever it is, maybe a chatbot can be used, right, just to solve that access issue and the availability and the affordability issue of mental health services. However, for me, this again, this ties in with the risks of making or thinking of AI systems as anthropomorphic, right, as if they're human when they're not. And I know what it's like to need mental health support and to want to talk to someone about the issues that we are facing. I think it's a very important part of a human experience to talk to a friend, to talk to your family, to talk to, I don't know, priest or therapist. However, with chatbots, I have a problem, first of all, on the data protection side. A lot of the chatbots that are on the market do not give the guarantee that they do not save your data or where those data that you're sharing go to, which from a children's rights perspective, that's a nightmare waiting to happen. And the second part is a lot of the chatbots, even if they kind of, they say, okay, I'm a chatbot, you need to be aware that you're not talking to a human. They still imitate human speech or human patterns of behavior, but they're not actually feeling the feelings. They're not actually providing the empathy. They're not providing the support. They're simply replicating language patterns. And that lack of the actual understanding, for me, carries a risk that they are actually might make it worse for people who try to get support from a chatbot, right? You never know whether the response that you are getting would be correct or whether a chatbot would say something completely inappropriate. And as an adult, you might be able to gauge what is or is not supportive in a certain context. For a child, they would take it all at face value. And that is, if it's not helpful, if it actually has a detrimental effect, then that would exacerbate the mental health crisis rather than solve it. So for me, while acknowledging the difficulties with access and affordability and mental health stigma, I think we need to be a lot more careful when saying, yes, AI can be a solution there. What kind of solution? That's a question. Chatbots are probably not.
Okay, so you're not convinced about, at least at this stage, about the use. Irina, you work for an international organization. As the EU is working on its UAI Act, the UK has its safety initiative, the US is trying, we have an election year, so we'll see what happens. What are your thoughts on the importance of international collaboration and standardization efforts as far as regulations on AI is concerned?
Oh, it's very important that we standardize and kind of find a way to find provisions in the legislations of all countries, right? Not just a selected few, but for the whole world. And the UN is doing a lot. So the Secretary General has the high-level advisory body that is going to develop a framework for this, but also the UN system in general is contributing to this. And I'm going to mention UNESCO, UNICEF, and ITU doing a lot for this. For me, the main need for the international regulations and the international harmonization of standards for AI, audit for AI, deployment for AI risk management comes from the fact that we've mentioned in the beginning that a lot of systems, they don't know borders, right? They are not limited by the national borders just because the system has been developed in the EU or elsewhere does not mean that it's not going to be deployed in the US. So if something goes wrong, if that system discriminates or if it provides incorrect outputs, who is going to bear the responsibility? How we are going, which standards from which country are going to apply? And if we look at other technologies, like the history of how regulations and international standards have been developed, we know that, 100 years ago, cars were this big, new, shiny thing, and everybody was super excited about it. And we can readily admit that, yes, cars have been a really great innovation. And without cars and buses and trucks, our societies would have looked very different. But somebody at some point had to have a bright idea of, hey, guys, wouldn't it be nice if all of our road signs looked the same? Right? And the same standards applied to seat belts and crash tests. Right, developing that shared understanding of what safety means also enables innovation because it helps us to move forward with a shared understanding of what the baseline is, and then we just grow from there. So just like road signs and regulations did not stop car development, I'm very sure that we need international standards for AI.
That's a good example of cars, Irina. Irina, finally, we have an audience that's global. We have members of Congress, Senate, their staff, think tanks, etc. Final thoughts from you to them, to our global audience, what would you like to tell them?
I'd like to circle back to the importance of involving stakeholders that probably have been marginalized in a lot of conversations, and that includes perspectives from the global south, that includes civil society organizations that represent particular groups such as people with disabilities and children. So that would be like the main takeaway. Please do involve people who are maybe like you, but not necessarily like you. And then the second message is the importance of collaboration. There is not a single organization, that is not a single country, that is not a single company, that is not a single person that can solve all of our problems and make it all magically perfect. But together, collaborating on developing legislation or collaborating on developing responsible AI systems, we can actually solve societal problems. We can actually develop regulations and legislation and policies that help people all over the world. And we can actually build responsible AI that makes our future planet a little bit better. So encouraging collaboration with UNICEF would be one of my messages.
That's a fantastic message. Give people who are marginalized a seat at the table and collaborate. That's why we have this podcast. We listen to amazing people with amazing perspectives like you, because it's going to take many different perspectives. So thank you so much, Irina, for being with us, for sharing your views. I learned a lot. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Sanjay. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to the Regulating AI Innovate Responsibly podcast. You'll find links in the show notes to any resources mentioned on the show. If you're enjoying our podcast, please subscribe so you'll never miss an episode and leave us a 5-star review.